Thanks and foremost to everybody who was involved in putting this evening together. Thank you very, very much to the Mizrahis for letting us bombard your home, for waking up Yoni. Yoni, thank you for having us. Thank you so much for being here with us. It's never too early to start learning about Shalom Bayis. This is great. I was part of a Shalom Bayis Vod when I was very, very much single, when I first got to Yeshiva. And it was great. It was great. So you're starting even younger than I am, and I think it's very, very wise. Very, very wise. Wise beyond your years. Thank you. Thank you to my wife. Thank you. That's a good idea to Shalom Bayis. Nice. Thank you to my wife. Yeah, right? Yeah, smooth. Thank you to my wife. Thank you to Melanie. Thank you to Ari for everyone who helped to amass the food, whether or not it's being served, even if some of it may or may not have been forgotten in the shul by someone who had his mind elsewhere on another presentation he may have been giving this evening. Anyway, thank you for everybody for Chatayani Maskir Ayom. Anyway, I'm very, very sorry. So it was supposed to be bread, and my apologies. Okay, Kruta, whatever else it was. Okay, wonderful. Wonderful. However, let's begin. The notion here and the idea, the title, is the dating mindset. This is not just about actually going on dates, which means that even if you're here, even if you're in this room, and even if you've left your kids behind or you've gotten out of the house and you're here and you're eating delicious food together, nevertheless, this is not really the be-all and end-all. It is a mindset. It's a mentality. It's a mentality. And really, more than anything, that's what I want to discuss. The notion that once upon a time, all of us were in a position when we thought about the person who is now our spouse in something of a different capacity. We're in a different mode. We're on a different wavelength. And the reality of life, and the reality especially of marriage, is that we start to lose some of that, some for the better, but also some, let's be honest, for the worse. There's a certain freshness, there's a certain excitement, there's a certain novelty when you're in the process of dating and the mode of dating that is a very, very healthy place to be in terms of the way that we interact with our spouses. And that's really what I wanted to try to address and to try to put on the table for this evening. There is a story that's told. I think I'm recording. I'm recording. That's very flattering. Revitin, thank you so much. By the way, and I should just point out, right? The reality is, some people in this room maybe think that I came here to lecture my wife. Some people in the room think that I came just to lecture everybody else. I actually came to lecture myself, right? There's something of an unspoken rule. There's this tacit assumption whenever there's a person at the front of the room that must be the person with all the expertise. That must be the person who's able to lecture everyone else on whatever topic it may be. This is absolutely a work in progress for me in my own personal life. These are things that I think that I need to be more mindful of personally, and I don't think there's any shame whatsoever in admitting that. At Baruch Hashem, I'm blessed with a very, very, very wonderful, wonderful marriage, and yet it can always improve. You can always take another step up, and hopefully that's where we all are. So the story is told. The story is told of a work site, and there is a warden over this massive, massive work site, massive construction site. And he notices something at some point as he's making the rounds and checking up on all the workers and all the construction as it's going. There is some fella who has a wheelbarrow, and there is a tarp over the top of the wheelbarrow. It's clipped to the side so that he cannot see what's under it. He doesn't belong there. He's not wearing any of the equipment. He knows that he's not supposed to be working there. And he's sneaking out with this wheelbarrow full of something. And he stops and he says, "Excuse me, can I help you? Who are you and what are you doing?" I didn't think anybody would mind. I have this project at home. I need a lot of sawdust. And I saw all the construction going on, and the sawdust keeps on piling up and up and up. And I just thought it wouldn't be, you know, it's all going to go in the trash anyway. If it's okay, I would bring it home. I heard, I saw online, there's a YouTube, that if you like mix it in with your compost and it's better. And it's the guy's looking at him like very, very suspiciously. He says, "Sawdust? You're stealing, you're taking sawdust?" Yeah, it's a wheelbarrow full of sawdust. Can you lift up the tarp and can I take a look? So he unclips it from the side, he peels it open, sure enough, it's a pile of sawdust. So the warden, he like, you know, rolls up his sleeve, he sticks his hand in, and he feels around, you know, like where's the goods, where are the tools, what's going on? Nothing. Sawdust. He says, "All right, you're welcome to it." Next day, he sees the exact same guy. And again, wheelbarrow, tarp over the top, clip to the sides. "What is going on? What are you doing?" He says, "Buddy, just a wheelbarrow full of sawdust. That's all it is. I have a project. That's what I'm doing at home." This happens over the course of an entire week. Finally, he says, "What's under the tarp? Come on, what is going on?" Same stuff as yesterday and the day before and the day before. I told you, big project at home. I need the sawdust. Can I see it? He unsheaths the tarp from the top. He sees it's a pile of sawdust. Listen, I have to level with you. I'm a little suspicious. I think something's going on. I think you're trying to pull a fast one on me. And I want to know what it is. You have my word. I won't stop you. I won't alert the authorities. I won't report you. You got to tell me what is going on. I'll let you get away with murder. I just need to know. So he leans into the warden and he whispers in his ear, I'm stealing wheelbarrows. So tonight is a class on stealing wheelbarrows. So often we miss the forest for the trees. We miss the underlying assumptions, the underpinnings of whatever it is that we're doing, because we're looking at the top. We're looking at the superficial. We're looking at what is built above, that we don't give enough credence and enough attention to what is happening beneath the surface. And that is a critical, critical point when it comes to everything that we try to do in life, when it comes to everything that we try to accomplish as people, as human beings, and specifically in Yiddishkeit, we make a major, major deal over the notion not only of shifting the behavior, but shifting the attitude as a means to shifting the behavior. An unbelievable quote from Rav Chaim Vital. This is probably something that we know. We actually just came across this. I don't regularly learn Rav Chaim Vital. I'm flattered if you think that I do. I'm not yet 40, but very soon I'll be learning Rav Chaim Vital Keseder. In the interim, I came by this by way of Ali Shor. And Revolba actually quotes Rav Chaim Vital saying as follows. He notes that, Ein ha-midos mechal ha-tayag mitzvos. It's true. Midos are not really part of the tarayag. Midos are not part of the 613. These are not things that you must do and must accomplish as actual behaviors. If you want to know what is it that is going to be the clincher as to whether you fulfill mitzvos or your mevatel mitzvos, it is the underlying midos. It's not the sawdust, it's the wheelbarrow beneath it that we so often lose sight of. Ya'an ki ein koach benefesh ha-sichlis l'kayim ha-mitzvos ha-yidei tarayag evari ha-guf, elo be'emtzos nefesh ha-yesodis ha-mechuberes el ha-guf atzmo. The reality is that we cannot simply position our intellect to make all the proper choices, all the proper decisions. When we're in a moment when we're supposed to choose A or B, and we know that A is the mitzvah and that B is the chet, we cannot forever be in position where we're always making the right decisions unless the actual operating system beneath, the actual guts, the mechanics beneath, is actually programmed to make that selection, to make that choice. I'm not chayev to have a particular midah. I'm chayev in a given behavior, but I can't get to that behavior unless I have the underlying midah, unless I have the underlying attitude. So how critical it is that we consider where our attitudes are, where our midos are. A.B. Rottenberg once said that midos are the way we act and how we think and feel. It's not true. Everybody has Sakasha on the song, and it's right. It's right. Midos are not the way we act and how we think and feel. Midos are the way we think and feel. And as a function of the way we think and feel, we therefore sometimes act in a certain way. Generally, usually. Once you set the program, once you have the midos, our greatest bechira lives in the selection of which midos we inculcate, which midos we assimilate, and then what happens afterwards is more or less going to be a function of those midos. This is what we must do. We can become either a mitzvah machine or an avera machine. That's going to be the natural output, purely based on the midos that we have, purely based on the actual soil that lies beneath all of the output, everything else that it is that we are otherwise producing, which really brings us to the next mashal, and it's a really, really critical one. If we want to be machines of Shalom Bayis, so then to some degree, we have to actually just change our thinking. We have to change our attitudes. We have to change the way that we think, our midos with regards to Shalom Bayis, the atmosphere, the environment in which our marriages are actually operating may need a shift. An incredible, incredible insight of Rav Volba. Rav Volba notes, these are the first words of Mesillas Yesharim. If you've ever learned Mesillas Yesharim, this probably has stuck with you. Yesod ha-chasidus v'shorosh ha-avoda. It's not uncommon that when you begin a work, if you ever write a sefer, if anybody's in the process of writing a sefer, Charlie, maybe you could get away with this in the introduction. Maybe. You start with a yud-kei, vav-kei. That's a thing. That's a deal. That's an inyan. But it's not coincidental. It's not accidental. It's not haphazard. Yesod ha-chasidus, V'shoresh ha'avoda. What is the yesod? The yesod is a foundation that you lay when you are constructing, when you are building. What is a shoresh? A shoresh is the construction, is the foundation, sorry, that you lay, not when you're constructing, not when you're building, but when you are planting. Maybe you have seen, maybe you've read, maybe you've thumbed through Rav Olda's excellent work. It's actually translated by Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman. And in Planting and Building, Rav Olda talks about the distinction between the two. This is really a book about chinuch. It's really a book about chinuch. But in the introduction, he speaks about the Maseilas Yesharim's introduction, of those very first words, the difference between yesod and shoresh, the difference between building on the one hand, planting on the other. And he notes that Chassidus demands a foundation. Chassidus constitutes the top floor in the construction of a human being, and construction always requires a foundation. You have to build. Sometimes we need direct involvement in constructing and manipulating ourselves. What is that behavior going to look like? How is it that you're going to act? And how do you learn the skill and the tactic to be able to do what you want to be able to achieve? To reach the heights of Chassidus, we first lay a strong foundation, and then we build on it. Divine service, on the other hand, avoda, evolves organically from within. Both are critical. Both are important. Such growth requires a root, Ramchal hints. Where there is no root, there can be no growth. We must sow internal seeds that will sprout during our lifetime. The notion of planting is that there are certain things that we do. We create an environment. We till the soil. We fertilize the soil so that things will just happen naturally. So to be clear, both are critical, both are important. In whatever arena of our lives where we want to be successful, this is true in Ruchnius, it's true in Gashmius, it's true in our professional lives, it's true in our spiritual lives, it's true in our davening, it's true in the way that we manage our offices and our practices. This is true everywhere. It's true outside the home, it's true inside the home. This is not really a discussion about building. Building is also important, specific tactics and specific skills. Every one of us gets to a point where, even if we have all the right attitudes, we have the right environment in our homes and in our marriages, in our bias, there's still going to come a point where, okay, but how do you actually reconcile when you've gotten into a fight? How do you actually deal with strife? How do you actually deal with tension? How do you actually learn to talk to one another in a way when both insist that they are absolutely right? I'm more needy. No, I'm more needy. No, I'm more needy. No, I'm more needy. How do you navigate that? For this, you make an appointment, and I'm going into private practice, and we're going to and send you a bill in the mail. But tonight is not about that. Critically important, and so much of that really pertains to particulars, and it's very difficult to discuss in broad strokes. But in broad strokes, we can speak about planting, and planting is really, really critical. Developing an environment in which, one that we used to have, but developing an environment in which our marriages can really thrive, our bias can really thrive. One, again, that I would dare say we used to have. There used to be an environment and an atmosphere that was pervasive in our relationship, or in which the relationship actually grew inside of, which was one of dating, which was one of trying to, I'm going to use this again and again, where we were trying to, not that we became so comfortable that we didn't have to think anymore, but there was an excitement in seeing one another, where there was a need to, even once you get to a point, no, I think it's going well, and I really think we're gonna get engaged, and then we're engaged right now, we're gonna get married. There was a sense that we were trying to woo one another. There was a sense that I was still trying to win this person over. There was a sense before, I've been married for 5 years and 10 years and 20 years. There was a sense that I still need to impress you. And how do we get back to that point? How do we get back to that sort of environment? Because when we're in that environment, so much that's positive really flows as a direct function. When there's that built-in respect, when there's that built-in novelty, when there's that built-in excitement that I'm so looking forward to seeing you at day's end, there's so much of the trouble and the problems that we ultimately find ourselves in that just dissipate, that just never really exist. Building is also important. But when we've planted and when we've laid the right terrain, so much just takes care of itself automatically. So let's talk about tools and tactics in creating this sort of environment. First of all, let's talk about words and deeds. I absolutely love this. Maybe you'll remember this, maybe you won't. A great quote. How's your bride? Margie Siegel. Right, yeah? You ever hear her say this? This is embedded in my mind. Who's Margie Siegel? No, surely you know who Margie Siegel is. Really? You call yourself a professional? You don't know? Margie Siegel. Margie Siegel is a woman that there's no reason that anybody should have heard of, but she was a dear, dear friend, congregant, neighbor when we lived in Toledo. Margie and Mel were, I don't know, at the time, were like 50 years our senior, 40 years or something like that. Which meant they were kind of the youngsters in the show there. Anyway, on more than one occasion, Justin asking, like, instead of asking, how's your wife, I remember Margie asking, how's your bride? I love that. How's your bride? And what if we all thought along those lines, just in terms of the words that you choose, the words you select, how's my kala? How's my chasen? Right, that you're still sort of in the throes of thinking about one another in that capacity. Right, the same way that every single day, the kol continues to emanate from Har Sinai. Right, there's still this ongoing hischadshus. There's this ongoing novelty in terms of our relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. Every day we have to reset the program. Every day you got to get up and moda'ani fresh, and etilas yadayim fresh, and shachris fresh. Every single day we need to be makabel ol malchus shamayim and ol mitzvos all over again. We have to accept the yoke all over again, and hopefully HaKadosh Baruch Hu accepts us all over again. What if we lived with that sort of sense, even just in terms of the words that we choose, that we're still choosing each other, that we're still selecting one another? But it's not just I'm in it and I'm already here and I've already arrived. But how's your bride? Hello, my bride. Hello, my groom. Hello, my chassan. Hello, my kala. I just think it's such a sweet way. Maybe it feels totally unnatural. It's okay, because you can just blame it on the fact that, oh, remember the rabbi said that really corny thing. So blame it on me. But get in the habit every now and again of using that kind of language around one another. That the person in your life, yes, obviously, I'm not going anywhere, and you're not going anywhere, and therefore I don't need to impress you. I do need to impress you. You're my bride. I do need to impress you. You're my kala. I do need to impress you. You're my chassan. I still have to win you over until we actually get to the chuppah. And yes, every single day after that, I still need to win you over. I need to woo you. I need to impress you. Which, you know, we get to a point. you get to a point where you can slip into a state of just letting it all hang out. Why? Because I'm not trying to impress anybody anymore. If you've ever thought, if you've thought about, you know, I want to get in better shape, I don't want to be able to look better, I don't want to like change my clothes, and I need a new wardrobe. For what reason? For what purpose? And don't share it right here, but just think about it. Who was it to impress? Is to impress the other ladies in the shul, is to impress the other guys in the shul, is to impress the people in the office, it was to impress my Talmidim, because you know you have to be like with it now. If you don't wear a really crisp like starch shirt, Baruch Hashem, we're not like in New York, but you know, but otherwise, you know, if the Rebbe doesn't look absolutely slick and spiffy, then how are you ever supposed to get their attention? I need to impress the Balabatim, I need to impress the Rabbi, I need to impress the Rebbetzin, I need to impress the friends. Is there ever a point at which I need to look really good? Because I need to impress my spouse. I need to impress my spouse. I need to win them over. And when we're getting dressed in the morning and going like that little extra mile, this doesn't mean. The Ramah, in the very, very first siman, in the very first sif of Shulchan Aruch, says, Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Summit, it's a kal gadol betorah. We should always be mindful of the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in the room, and therefore our behavior is going to be different. What does it mean that your behavior is different when Hashem is in the room? It doesn't mean you never go to the bathroom. It doesn't mean you never take a shower. It doesn't mean you never go to a mikvah. It doesn't mean that you never get into your pajamas. It doesn't mean that you're never in a state because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was always watching me. But that degree of consciousness does change how we act and how we behave, even when we're in the shower, and even when we're in the bathroom, and even when we're in our pajamas. It doesn't mean to say that you always have to be in like a top hat and tails. And it doesn't mean to say, and I don't mean to say, that there's never a place for lounging and for being at ease and for changing into your pajamas, but a little bit of consciousness. Are there things that, yeah, I've just gotten to the point where I'm like comfortable enough to just do the like grossest thing in the world that I would do only if I was completely in private? I'm basically in private. Why? Because it's in the bag. Because what? Because I'm not going anywhere, and he's not going anywhere, I'm not going anywhere, she's not going anywhere, we're in it, the reality is that we should have this sense that I always need to try to impress. Again, we are spending a life with the other. We're spending a life with our spouse. That means that they're going to see us at our worst. That means that they're sometimes going to be the person to hold my hair or my ponytail, could be a man or a woman, or my beard when I'm heaving over the toilet. That's going to be my spouse. We're spending life together. It means that they're going to see me in the hospital. It means that they're going to see me in this position, in that position. It means it's not always going to be pretty. But whenever I can, to have the sense that I'm still trying to impress. I'm trying to woo. I'm trying to win over. You're my bride. You're my kali. You're my chazen. I'm trying to get to the chuppah. I'm trying to make sure that you are as enthusiastic about getting there as I am. And when we behave in that manner, when we behave in that capacity, we ourselves become more excited. It's an absolutely remarkable thing. I didn't put it in here, but we know that the word ahava, Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch talks about this, Rav Dessler talks about this, the word ahava, the word love, comes from the word hav. Hav is to ahava, ahava. Awesome. Get rid of the alf, get rid of the hey. In the middle you have hey, vez, hav. Hav is to give. When we give, we love. I was just talking to my daughter about this. I forget how it came up. We were talking about how, love, what is love exactly, and is it just a, thanks, somebody had to, that it's semantics to a certain degree, but we talk about, like, does love come before marriage, does love come after marriage, it's like, I don't know exactly, right, it cannot be that the greatest emotional content comes only before marriage, that can't be the case, right, it constantly gets built upon, but also, look, if I were to say that in the firm world, I don't know, we're not necessarily so focused on whether you is it love? Is it the deepest level of ahava? What is it exactly? You know that you're going into something great and something really, really, really beautiful. Everybody else in the world, everybody else on the planet would say, nah, you have to be deeply, madly in love before you actually get married. Where does that get them? Where does that get everyone else? Where is the divorce rate? Right? If ahava in advance only gets you to a point of like a 50% success rate in marriage, then who needs it? What difference does it make? Why is that a better system? This is something that we should be constantly working on. And the neat thing about ahava is that when you actually give and when you try and when you invest in the relationship, you actually become more invested yourself. You actually become more interested and more intrigued when you are trying to impress your spouse. You also become more impressed by your spouse. This is really another component. It's of the same thing, but complimenting, right? Certainly would have happened when you're trying to impress, when you're trying to win over, when you're trying to woo, when you're trying to, like, I want you to come to the chuppah. I'm like, I'm ready to go, and I'm trying to convince you also. So you'll compliment, you'll say nice things, you'll hold the door open, you'll look for those subtle ways to show and to say that you're really important to me. And if we've fallen out of habit, so let's just get back into habit. Just turn the dial forward just a little bit. We know that we can because we've done it before. Certainly, if we've been convincing enough and compelling enough to get our spouse to the chuppah, then we must have exhibited this behavior at some point. It's a matter of just being that much more mindful and trying to reinstate some of those practices that we have always had. An incredible nice, I just read this, Rabbi Yisrael Tauber, who's a big Shalom Bias, he has a lot about families and relationships, said he was once visiting Eretz Yisrael and he asked to go meet with the Baba Sali. And the Baba Sali said, yes, I want you to come tomorrow, come to Netivot, I want you to come tomorrow specifically in the middle of the day. There's no Arak involved in this particular story. No Arak was harmed in this particular story. But he said, I want you to come for lunch. Are we going to come for lunch? Fine, good. He came to the door, welcomed him inside, very good, and he had a seat. And from that moment forward, there's not a word spoken to Rabbi Tauber. There was no conversation between the Baba Sali and Rabbi Tauber. Rabbi Tauber sat in the corner and food was served, and as each dish was served by the Rebbetzin, I don't know what you call a Baba Sali Rebbetzin. Rabbanit Sa, no, but Rabbanit Sima. Is that really how it goes? Rabbanit Sima. So the Rabbanit, not Rebbetzin, Rabbanit, Pashtus not, right? Rabbanit, so she came and she would serve one thing. And there was all this is so good, this is how did you make this? You know, this is like the last time, like they were teenagers.
like they're a teenager. And she would giggle and she would blush and she would say, oh, stop, I make this all the time. You're flattering me. No, this, I can't believe that. Delicious. This is amazing. This is what is it Tayyim? I'm not.
Right? I think it was all in Arabic, actually. Right? And he didn't really, know what was going on. Rabbi Tauber wrote, like, I didn't really know what was going on, but you get a sense of the emotional content and the emotional bond between these two people. He said, the Rav did not say a word to me. And we finished the seuda, and we benched, and he escorted me out. And I'm like, what in the world? What just happened? And he realized, oh, he wanted me to see what a meal between a husband and wife should look like. Here I speak about Shalom Bayis, and here I write about Shalom Bayis. This is what it's supposed to look like. You could be married for 40 years, and there is this sort of playful banter and the complimenting. The soup is wonderful, and the bread is wonderful. How do you make? You ask me every time. You know how. You're so silly. You're so delightful. And that's what it should look like when you are in constant process of trying to woo and win the other party. That's what it looks like, and it creates an environment. It doesn't mean that there won't be those times that you get home tired and hungry and exhausted and cranky, and I just need you to listen to me. Oh, you know what kind of day I had? You know, kind of day, well, you're cranky and exhausted and tired at the office. I've been dealing with, 57 cranky, tired, whatever, because it's not just our kids, but they also seem to have invited all the cranky and tired and hungry and obnoxious kids in the entire neighborhood. And I bumped my foot on the, because I don't know why everybody, I need you to listen. I need to just relax. I can't have you relax. Those things will happen. Those things will absolutely happen. And again, how do you deal with those and what are the tactics? That's a little bit more building and the skills and whatever. But there is, when there are all these deposits that have already been made, when there's an atmosphere that is pervasive of, we enjoy each other's company, I'm trying to win you over, I'm trying to impress you, you can tolerate so many more of those infractions than you otherwise possibly could. And here it is directly, dating mindset, just having a mindset, we can't just be Jews at heart. All right, I'm so frum in my own head. Me and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have a wonderful relationship. When was the last time you davened? 13 years ago. Right? I cannot just have a dating mentality and not actually date. Go out, find ways. It doesn't need to be expensive. And yes, part of the expense is, what do you mean? Just leaving the house is expensive because of babysitting. It could be the back porch. It could just be a time. It could be a walk around the neighborhood. It could be a walk around or up and down the driveway. It could just be time that is actually slated and scheduled where we're going to be with one another. Some people will tell you that, and you don't talk about kids. I don't know. We'll get to it. Kids are an important part of life. to say, and we're not, because we have to be people who are independent. If the only thing you ever talk about is kids and you don't have any sharing of values and dreams and goals and ambitions and what else is going on in other arenas of your life, that could be a problem. But kids are a very, very important part of life. Get to another very, very important quote later. But find the time. It doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be a vacation. You don't have to go to Aruba. If you go to Aruba, matoy v'manam. If you can go to Barbados, matoy v'manam. If you can go to whatever, It's beautiful. If you can go out for dinner every week and you can afford it, then gesunta hate. But it doesn't need to be. It doesn't have to be. Incredible thing from Rav Yaakov. Rav Yaakov says, Zenemus Liyakov, I think Parshas Shmos. I think it's the end of Parshas Shmos. Rav Yaakov is answering the following question. What's the story? Moshe Rabbeinu tries to pull the wool over Paro's eyes. It's not right. He says, yeah, we just need 3 days out in the Midbar. 3 days there, one day in the Midbar, 3 days back. We'll be back in a week. Not going to be back in a week. You're trying to bolt. And Paro knows it, and Hashem knows it, and we know it, and Moshe Rabbeinu knows it. Chosam HaShal HaKadosh Baruch Hu Emes. Come on, being a chakra towards Paro. Tell him like it is. We're leaving for good. There are going to be Nisim and Niflaos, miracles, in order to break us out of here if need be, but we're leaving for good. What's with the whole charade of we're just leaving for a week? Says Rabbi Yaakov, it was absolutely sincere. The initial intention was to leave for but a week. Why? Remember, they were supposed to be there for how long? 400 years. How long were they actually there for? 210. So when they first started this process, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's idea was, you'll leave for a week, you'll come back, you'll finish the 190, and then Geula, and then you'll leave. What is that 1 week supposed to do for them? Here's what happened. V'ra'a Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw, she'enim yecholim lehishtahus ad sof hazman. They weren't going to be able to make it. They wouldn't last. Ki achar kach lo yetzu.
Because if they would wait the entire time, then they'd never be able to leave. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you know what you need? You know what you need when you're at a breaking point? When you're at a breaking point, you need a break. You just need to get out for a week. You just need to re-inspire yourselves. Chavetz HaKadosh Baruch Hu sheyochel l'zman katzar. He says, get out. Just go for a short period of time. Lachud b'midbar. Have a chag. Have a chag. Have a holiday. Have a yontif out in the midbar. Bring karbanos. You'll re-inspire yourselves. You'll have chizuk. It'll be a rendezvous between yourselves and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'shem hayu ma'urim b'kirbam ikre ha'amuna shekiblu me'avoseihem. They'd become re-inspired. They'd go back over all the svarim, all the kontrasim and everything that their avos had written them. They would go back over all of the principles and all the values that they'd been taught, and they're going to re-inspire themselves and bring karbanos, and they're going to come back rejuvenated and refreshed. Because it's at the beginning of the process. Another 191 years. Ad hashlamas dalet hameos, until they get to the end of the 400. What does that say? What does that indicate? Sometimes a well-situated break from the norm to re-inspire, to rejuvenate, to reinvigorate, you can go back into the throes and the complications and the difficulties of life with new vigor, with freshness. You can tolerate so much more once you've had that break, once you've had that getaway. If that break can be 3 days in the Cayman Islands, kuzantahit. If that break is one night out, you go out to dinner, phenomenal. If that date means that you take, you know, Monopoly you can't play Trouble while the kids are asleep, because whatever, something that doesn't make any noise, and you go to the bit, you go someplace that nobody's gonna hear, nobody's gonna know, and that's it. You light a couple of candles, and you're sitting on the back porch, and if anybody wakes up, we're still here. Make those times. Take a break. Have an opportunity to rejuvenate, to be with one another, be in that mindset of dating. Because when you have that atmosphere, so many of the problems are solved, me'elav. Something that I think we have to be mindful of also, that even if we do nothing else other than just being conscious of this, sometimes the language, it's too late for us. Oh, forget it. Yeah, back when we were newlyweds. It's like 3 years ago. You're young people. Oh, yeah, this is before the kids came. Like, you know, got two kids. And I forget it. Oh, yeah. Are you okay? What do you mean, like Ben Gay? Are you all right? Like, you're like talking with a grumble and you're hunched over. Everything all right? Crying out loud, you're 27 years old. Right? So sometimes we just get to a point, forget it. It's too late for us. It's just over. We have kids and forget it. It's done and it's gone. And we're just, you know, this old married couple and never and will never reignite. We're too saddled with too much real life stuff. Adulting. There's too much real stuff. Too much kids and planning and everything. Doctor's appointments and the socks never. Why can the socks never match? So where do they go? And it's just in fear. There's so much. We're just being weighed down. Forget it. It's just too late for us. We should be aware of a couple of things. Dr. Gottman, John Gottman, whose stuff is great, great, speaks a lot about love maps and enhancing love maps. Love maps are the things that we have in common. Whenever any of my kids, I don't use this exact sprach, but whenever any of my kids, they go to like a new situation, they're in a new camp, they're going to a new class, a new this, a new that, a new friend, whatever. It takes time, but know that after you've spent some time and you have some of that common experience and you have some of that common language, then you'll be able to be much better friends and things will go much. It's hard at the beginning, but by the time you are deeply embedded in that relationship or in a marriage, you have these love maps. Example, these couples have made plenty of cognitive room for their marriage. They remember the major events in each other's history. They keep updating their information as the facts and feelings of their spouse's world change. When she orders him a salad, she knows what kind of dressing he likes. If she works late, he'll think to record her favorite TV show. He could tell you how she's feeling about her boss and exactly how to get to her office from the elevator. They know each other's life goals, worries, and hopes. In all likelihood, if we were to fill out a survey about our spouse, we'd probably do pretty well. And if not, then good. So that's an area to really try to improve. But in the average marriage, for the average couple, you're already there and we just don't realize it. We don't think to pat ourselves on the back. We don't think to reward ourselves or to give ourselves, good for you, Yasher Koyach. There's so much that I already know about my spouse. And just that knowledge means so much. It means I'm actually in a better place now than I was when we were
dating because there's so much more information that I have. I'm so much more deeply involved and deeply integrated into my spouse's life. And that is no small thing. The Torah tells us it's no small thing. Has this ever occurred to you that the first time we find an act of intimacy between Adam and Chava, very, very first couple, very first man and woman, v'ha'adam yoda es Chava ishto v'tar v'teled es kayin. How does the Torah refer to the act of intimacy between man and woman? Yedi'ah. Knowledge. Knowledge. Knowledge is intimacy. The more you know about a person, the more intimate you are with them, the more intimately involved in their life you are. Which means that by definition, combination of giving, hav and ahava, and a combination of, and as well as yedia, we are in deeper love, further along in the relationship than we were at the beginning. It might not be so novel. And novelty and freshness and rejuvenation, it's all good, it's all important. But let's take stock of the fact that just the fact that we are this many years in is huge. That's a big deal. I know so much about you. I understand you. I understand your world. I know exactly what to do in order to upset you. I know exactly which buttons to push when I'm trying to tick you off. That's no small thing. I didn't know that when we were first dating. That's great. Look, see, so we have what in common. There's really something to that. It means that we are more intimately involved with one another. Just that knowledge, just the ability to say, wow, that's accomplishment. That's an accomplishment in of itself. And to pat ourselves in the back and to reward ourselves and to think of it as being an achievement in this and as an accomplishment, not that this is an albatross around me. Oh, I know you too well by now. Oh, it's all over. Yeah, forget it. We're this old. There's glory and there's beauty and there's achievement in being that old married couple, even if we've only been, I don't know, married for a couple of years and we think that we're already there. Something else again. Back to the point of, oh, don't talk about kids. Don't talk about kids. Don't only talk about kids. But let's also be conscious of the fact that if you are blessed with children, that is an enormous step towards positivity and good development in a relationship. Says Rav Soloveitchik, to love means to share an identity. He says this on Parshas Bereishis. On Parshas Bereishis, when Adam and Chava are first conceived their first child, and Adam says that etzem me'atzamayu basar mibsari, so he speaks about there's this union about how they've become one with one another. To love means to share an identity, one common destiny. If the lover and the beloved are united, then two persons who are in love with a third are also united. The love between a husband and wife is strengthened and deepened with the birth of a child. Having a child doesn't mean that love is over. It means that love is advancing. In fact, love in common is a stronger bond than thought in common. The link of hearts is stronger than that of minds. The fact that there is another that we both love, that we're both raising, or a series of others that we are trying to raise and that we're trying to cultivate together, that is more important, not less important, that is more important and more meaningful than the fact that, oh, remember we used to love painting pottery together. Shkayach, we used to love painting pottery together. Oh, we haven't painted pottery in so long together, and that means that we're not really in love anymore. No, love is deeper now. Love is more real now. You should also find time to go paint pottery. Because of a break and because of rejuvenation. But you are deeper now. There's more meaning now than there ever was before. Rashi explains that the one flesh, the unity, is realized by the creation of a child. The love of the couple changes into a more spiritual, exalted love through a shared creation, a common goal. Unqualified love of a child unites the parents, brings them closer to each other. Their love becomes more truthful, more intimate, and sincere. It's not superficial. It's not that, we both love axe throwing. We both love guns. We both love tractors. We both love, vintage hot rods from the 60s. Those are good things. Go have fun. Go back to Dave and Buster's. Whatever's your thing. We both love air hockey. If we don't play air hockey, that means we're not in love anymore. You're in deeper love. You're in more love. It's more real love. It's more genuine. It's more sincere. Two people, father and mother, welded together into one, all their concerns and aspirations concentrated on a new center, which becomes the emotional bond lining both of them. Indeed, it becomes the existential focus of their lives about which everything revolves. It's okay if life revolves around the kids. Life is supposed to revolve around the kids. But every now and again, just take a step back and appreciate what that means. It means that we have this shared, look at what we've done.
Look at the pictures up on the walls. Look at our beautiful family together. That's a wonderful and extraordinary. Look at what we've done. Right? That's so much better than like the nerdy pictures of when we were dating. We were holding. We were, you know, standing like on opposite sides of the room, and we were like leaning in. I need the salt shaker. I need the pepper shaker for our new bias. Good. Name the kid. That's so much better. That's so much greater. That's so much more meaningful. Oh boy, I struck a nerve with that. Wow. Okay. Oh my gosh, we really had the salt and the pepper shaker. Yeah, it's true. And then all the people, look, we went on a boat and we did this thing again, and like I won the big plush dog from the prize counter when we went bowling and we whatever it is. Good, wonderful, nice memories. It's not as deep. It's not as real. It's not as meaningful. We should appreciate that we are doing something so significant together, and that in and of itself can build love if we look at it properly. Final word about consciousness, or just about being aware of the beauty that we are already engaged in, already involved in. So this is an incredible thing. I think I've shared this before. I love coming back to this. This is just one of my favorite parallels in Shas. This is an incredible thing. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah spoke about this first part, I think this past Rosh Hashanah. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah notes the following. Amar Rav Chisna, mipnei mayim kohen gadol nichnas bebigdei zahav lefnayv lefnim la'avod avodah. Why is it that the kohen gadol changes out of his clothing? He doesn't wear the golden clothing, the clothing that is threaded with the gold thread that we learned about in this week's parsha, the parsha that we read this morning, Parshas Tetzav. He changes out of the big day Zav, and he changes into the big day Lavan before he goes lefnayv lefnim, before he goes into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, before he stands right before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So why does he do that? Says the Gemara, a fascinating halachic principle. Lefi she'in kategor na'ase sanegor. Because a prosecuting force, a negative force, cannot be leveraged to serve as an advocate for himself, for the Jewish people. What's the prosecuting force? Gold. Gold is bad. Gold is bad news. Don't remind HaKadosh Baruch Hu, standing in the Kodesh HaKadoshim on the holiest day of the year, on Yom Kippur, don't remind HaKadosh Baruch Hu of the Chet HaEgel. Don't remind him of the gold. Don't remind him of the sin of the gold. Don't wear the big day zahav. Aye, v'ha ikka big day zahav mibachutz. Even on Yom Kippur, the Kohen Gadol does wear the big day zahav. He just doesn't wear them into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So says the Gemara, that's the point. Mibifnim ka'amrinon. So the Gemara, there's a final point that the Gemara notes that shofar were also concerned. We spoke about this on Rosh Hashanah. Shofar were also concerned. Shofar, we only use a shofar, not a keren. We use a shofar from, let's say, a ram. We don't use a keren, a horn, from a para, from a bull, or from a cow. We don't use a keren. Why? Because, again, it's evocative. It's reminiscent of the Chet HaEgel. So the Gemara says a fascinating thing, that because of the unique nature of shofar, it's as though we're standing in the Kodesh HaKadoshim when we blow the shofar. Very good. What do you get from this Gemara? There is a halachic principle that you cannot mix and match. You cannot cross the streams. Kategor, sanegor, positive, negative, advocating element, advocating force, prosecuting force. They can't be mixed and matched. When? Kodesh HaKadoshim. Listen to this. Gemara in Kedushin. This is what we're learning this year in the Masechta. This is what we're learning in the Chabura on Monday nights. Amar Abaye, Yomru Kesef Machnis Kesef Motzi, Sanegor Yasa Kategor. Abaye says, you know how we know that you use kesef, you use a matbea, you use a ring, you use something of value to get married, can't use it to get divorced. Why not? Because if you would use the same thing, if you would use value, if you would use kesef, if you would use an object of monetary value, both to get married and also to get divorced, ein sanegor yase kategor. You can't have something that's supposed to serve as an advocating force to now serve as a prosecuting force. That's not true. That's not true. We do that all the time. The Kohen Gadol does it. He wears Big Day Zav on Yom Kippur in the Beis HaMikdash. Where is it true? It's true in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Abaye apparently sees absolutely no problem. He has no compunction. He has no hesitation with taking a principle that applies only and exclusively in the Kodesh HaKadoshim on Yom Kippur and applying it to marriage. Marriage. So a little bit of consciousness, just a little bit of consciousness of what it is that we've entered into with one another. What it means to be in this bond, what it means to be in this relationship, is to be standing inside of the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It means to invite a Kodesh Baruch Hu into our house. It means that we're engaged in the single greatest
greatest spiritual exercise imaginable, that we are closer with HaKadosh Baruch Hu when we are engaging properly in our marriages than we could possibly be doing by doing anything else. Unless you are the Kohen Gadol and you go into the Kodesh HaKadoshim, there's a chance, there's a hope. But meanwhile, and for the rest of us, marriage is where it's at. Last point. It's like my favorite. I've quoted this 1,000 times. It's so good. It's so good. The Medrash of Vayikra Rabba, and there are different versions of this, but the Medrash of Vayikra Rabba says that Rabbi Yochanan, also based on this week's parasha, Rabbi Yochanan, ki hava ayel lebesa, when Rabbi Yochanan would come into his house, what would he do? Minna'anea. He would shake, he would rattle, he would do something, jingle his keys, he would do something, knock on the door, give a little tap. Why? Mishum shenemar, because the Pasuk says, v'nishma kolo b'va'oel ha-kodesh. It's what happens when the Kohen Gadol goes into the Kodesh, goes into the Heichal. When he goes into the Beis HaMikdash, the Kohen Gadol, he had the pa'amonim. He had the bells at the bottom, at the hem of his me'il. He made noise when he entered. I'm going to make noise when I enter. The Kohen Gadol was not concerned about startling anyone. The Kohen Gadol was not concerned. It's not like the Kohen Gadol had to, are you decent? Everyone, can I come, anybody in the middle, and anybody like still having a pajama day inside? Right? There's no concern that when the Kohen Gadol comes into the Heichal that anybody's dressed inappropriately, that he's going to startle anyone. But when he came in, Lemaisa, he made noise. That was part of the garb. That was part of the begadim. When we come into our homes, we're entering that space. We're entering a space that is holy, that is imbued with HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Shechina. We should be aware of the fact that simply by dint and by virtue of the fact that we are married, that there is so much Kedusha in our home, we should be conscious of it. So yes, we should make an attempt at trying to work and trying to develop a sense of freshness and of excitement and of novelty, but also just celebrating the fact that I'm in something so critical, so huge, so important. It needs to be important to me. It needs to be important to my spouse. It's important to HaKadosh Baruch Hu to treat it sensitively, to treat it with all of the respect that it deserves, and to try to simply infuse more and more and more Kedusha and try and infuse more and more respect into our marriages. Give a little bit of a sense that we're in something and that we're involved in something that's so critical and so holy. There's a lot to discuss about the sawdust. There's a lot to discuss about the actual, some of the tactics, what happens again, what about this behavior, what happens, but when everybody starts fighting and when it's really tough and when it's really stressful, absolutely. But there's so much that we can do to simply create an environment in which that freshness is back, sense of dating, how it once was. I'm trying to win you over. I'm trying to impress you that there's value here, that it's important. It's important to have a bond, and it's important to be in a relationship that we value as much as the Kaddish Baruch Hu apparently does, that he considers to be no less than entering into the Kodesh HaKadoshim. Wishing everyone a tremendous hatzlacha in implementing and growing in working and in developing. Our marriages should only continue to grow and continue to rise higher and higher and higher, more and more holy, more and more and more respectful. And wishing everybody hatzlacha and myself hatzlacha and making sure that we all do it together. After all. Thank you.